Today we're reading from Colossians chapter 1, and I'm beginning to read at verse 15. Colossians chapter 1, verse 15. Jesus is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation. For by him all things were created, things in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or powers or rulers or authorities. All things were created by him and for him. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together. And he is the head of the body, the church. He is the beginning and the firstborn from among the dead, so that in everything he might have the supremacy. For God was pleased to have all his fullness dwell in him, and through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether things on earth or things in heaven, by making peace through his blood shed on the cross. Once you were alienated from God and were enemies in your minds because of your evil behavior. But now he has reconciled you by Christ's physical body through death to present you holy in his sight, without blemish and free from accusation. If you continue in your faith, established and firm, not moved from the hope held out in the gospel. This is the gospel that you heard and that has been proclaimed to every creature under heaven, and of which I, Paul, have become a servant. What offends people about Christianity these days, I suspect more than anything else, is its intolerance of its rivals. Everybody's entitled to their own opinion, we say. So why won't we allow the Muslims to find God in his way, and the Hindu to find God in his way, and the Buddhist to find God in his way? Why do these Christians insist that in the whole spectrum of world religions, Christianity is the only one that's right? Now, I can understand that objection very well, and the last thing I'd want to appear to be this morning is bigoted in any way. I've known over the years now, I met many representatives of a great many different world faiths, and I've entertained profound respect for many of them. But if I'm going to be honest with you, I have to say there is something inescapably exclusive about Christianity. At least Christianity, if it's going to be true to itself. Christianity, in a sense, can't help but be intolerant of its religious rivals. And the reason for that is quite simple. Jesus is unique. In our Bible passage this morning, the Apostle Paul spells out the reasons for that uniqueness. Many scholars believe Paul has actually incorporated or composed a Christian hymn in these verses 15 to 20 especially that we read. When you try to arrange it in a series of stanzas, it doesn't quite work, so it may be better to say he's simply writing in a very lyrical fashion. But if he is writing a hymn, there is one thing that's transparently obvious. It is a hymn to Jesus. Paul is affirming in the strongest possible terms here that wherever you look in the entire world, Jesus is without peer. There have been, no doubt, many great prophets, many great philosophers and saints and sages in the long centuries of human history. But there has never been, nor will there ever be, anybody to compare with him. He puts it in a single phrase in verse 18. He must have the supremacy, he says. And that word supremacy really epitomizes why Christianity can never see itself as no more than one more in the 57 Heinz-made varieties of world religious opinion. Jesus is unique. And the exclusiveness of Christianity is really just a reflection of the uniqueness of its founder and master. So So let's look at the passage together, and what I want you to do is to identify with me three reasons which I think Paul quite clearly gives us in these verses for affirming that Jesus must have the supremacy. The first is Jesus' unique relationship to God. Look at verse 15. He is the image of the invisible God, he says. Now I suppose the first question that any religion has to answer is, what's the nature of the ultimate reality? Or to put it in simple terms, what is God like? According to Paul here, the Christian answer to that is very simple. God is like Jesus. He is the image of the invisible God. If you come tonight, you'll see that I shall be using an overhead projector, one of these modern machines that we use instead of a blackboard. Very clever. I just write out on a little transparency what I want to show you all, and I put it on the machine, and it throws up a big picture of it on the screen that we hide behind those curtains. Of course, you won't be able to see the transparency. It'll be hidden from your eyes. It'll be lying in a horizontal plane, for a start, and it'll be quite small. But by this complex device of mirrors and lenses and lights and so on, an exact image of my transparency will be projected into a vertical plane. And that you will see. Maybe that helps understand what Paul is saying here when he speaks of Jesus. Jesus is the image of the invisible God. He is the projection into the dimensions of our space and time of a God who lies beyond those dimensions and who therefore cannot be seen by us. He precisely mirrors, reproduces the character of God. If you ask what is God like, then the best answer you can possibly give is, he is like Jesus. It's a staggering claim, of course. And to Paul's original hearers, it was as essentially incredible as it is to us, and many of them couldn't cope with it. Some of those early people he preached to, some of those early Christians, said, well, if it's so, Jesus can't possibly have been a real human being, can he? And how can anything made of flesh and blood accurately, fully mirror the divine nature? No, he must have just looked human, but really he must have been some kind of spirit manifestation, or an archangel, maybe. But if you look carefully, you'll see that Paul doesn't hold that view. In verse 22, he talks about Christ's physical body, literally, the body of flesh. Flesh was a word Paul only used, or very human people. Now, Jesus was a real man, with a real body. And if you ask, well, how's that possible if he is the image of God? The answer, of course, is that it's only possible because man is already, albeit imperfectly, like God. You know your Bibles well. You'll know that right at the beginning, when God made man, the book of Genesis records, he said, let us make man in our own image. And that verse may very well have been in Paul's mind as he wrote verse 15 here. Jesus is the image of the invisible God. We human beings, you see, are rational because God is rational. We are moral because God is moral. And what Paul is telling us here, in part anyway, is that in Jesus, God is showing us his original prototype for the human race. He's the die from which the human race in the image of God was originally struck. He's no angel or spirit. He doesn't have to be. He is man, but perfect man. Man in the image of God as man was meant to be. Saying that, of course, though, might leave the door open for yet another misunderstanding. A misunderstanding, again, the early Christians fell into. Well, they said, if what you mean when you say that Jesus is the image of the invisible God is simply that he is perfect man, then he can't also be fully God, can he? He can't have it both ways. After all, the photo of the pop star on your bedroom wall isn't the same as seeing your pop star in real life on the stage, is it? An image, no matter how good the likeness, isn't the original. So if Jesus is the human image of God, he can't be truly God at the same time, can he? Any more than you or I can. Though we may say we are, in a sense, the image of God. But once again, Paul answers that. Some might have said, well, Jesus was partly God, that a bit of God took up temporary residence in him. They might have allowed that. Some might have said that he was the kind of ideal of the spirit-filled man. They could have handled that. But Paul isn't happy with any such descriptions. You see how he puts it in verse 19. God was pleased to have all his fullness dwell in him. In a sense, that's a statement even more remarkable than the earlier one about him being the image of the invisible God. All the fullness of God, as we might say 100% of everything God is, was encapsulated within Jesus' human nature. He wasn't then the image of God in the way that a royal portrait is an image of the Queen. For a portrait, no matter how accurate, lacks an essential characteristic of Her Majesty. It isn't alive. But Jesus is the living image of God, not just a likeness, but the actual life of God. Animated him, dwelt in him. Indeed, that word dwell there in Greek indicates not just temporary residence, but permanent residence. He wasn't just partially or temporarily divine then. He wasn't a kind of spiritual hybrid, half man, half God, like the mythical centaur was half horse, half man. No, he was 100% human and 100% divine. His very flesh and blood were conceived by the Holy Spirit. So the Gospel tells us that even when there was only one cell of him in the womb of his mother, that cell was fully human and yet fully divine. The image of God eternally indwelt by the fullness of deity. That is Paul's assertion. Extraordinary? Certainly. But he won't assert any less. And that's the first reason Christianity can't allow itself to be put on the level with any other religion. For nobody else who has ever walked this earth could ever be described in such terms of unequivocal divinity. They may have been godly men, but only Jesus could say, "He who has seen me has seen God." Only of Jesus can it be truly said in this sense, "I and the Father are one." Only Jesus can have the supremacy. That brings me to the second reason Paul gives us for that proposition this morning. Not only Jesus' unique relationship to God, but also, he says, Jesus' unique relationship to the universe. "For by him all things were created," he says. "He is the firstborn over all creation. By him all things were created, things in heaven, on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or powers or rulers or authorities. All things were created by him and for him," he said. Now, if the first question any religion must try to answer is, "What is God like?" I suggest to you the second question any religion must try to answer might well be, "Why are we here?" This universe is the most unusual place, and the more our scientists discover about it, the more extraordinary it seems. Are we to really believe this universe is just a gigantic accident thrown together by random chance? But Paul insists it isn't so. No, he teaches us here the universe is a creation, that it is the product of God's design and purpose. Of course, there was nothing new in that. Jews had known about that and believed it for centuries on the basis of the Old Testament. In fact, one of the most popular ideas the Jewish sages and poets liked to discuss was the idea of the divine intelligence or wisdom as they called it, which had informed this amazing creative process. And many of the phrases Paul uses in this hymn are drawn from that body of Jewish literature. But the extraordinary and unexpected thing is that he uses these phrases not to describe the role of wisdom in creation, as the Jewish sages had. He uses these phrases to describe the role of Jesus in creation, at the hub of the design and purpose which underlies the universe, he says. There lies not just a divine attribute called wisdom, but a divine person called Jesus. He is God's wisdom personified, he says. And he expands what he means on that. This Jesus, he says for a start, existed before the universe. He is the firstborn over all creation. He doesn't mean by that word firstborn that Jesus was the first thing to come into being. There was a heresy in the early church which tried to use this text to prove that, and Jehovah's Witnesses perpetuate the same error today. But Paul isn't using the word firstborn in that pedantic sense of the first thing to be born, for if he were, it would imply that Jesus had a beginning in time and was therefore part of creation himself. And it's quite clear that Paul doesn't mean that here. So he says in verse 17, he is before all things. Jesus existed before anything in the created universe came into being. He is himself the beginning. And as if to make the point invincibly secure, he goes on to say Jesus couldn't possibly be a part of creation, not even the first part of creation, because he himself is the agent of creation. All things were created by him, he says. Now you may say, doesn't the Bible make out that all things are created by God? And of course it does. So you could scarcely imagine, could you, a more direct assertion of Jesus' deity than for a dyed-in-the-wool Jew like Paul, who knew the book of Genesis back to front, to say all things were created by him. The only way he could say it, of course, was because Jesus and God were inextricably entwined in his mind. They weren't two separate divinities. They were one, bound together in the work of creation, just like the hand and the head of a craftsman are bound together when they make something beautiful. And you notice how emphatic Paul is, that there is nothing in the whole universe outside of Jesus' creative agency. Whether thrones or powers or rulers or authorities, he says, all things were created by him. Now to our ear, that word throne and power and ruler and authority, it sounds like a description of political entities. And it isn't impossible that Paul may have had secular authorities in the back of his mind somewhere as he wrote it. But in first century Jewish vocabulary, these words were also descriptions of hierarchies of angels. And almost certainly that is what's principally in Paul's thought here. That's why he stresses that Jesus is the maker not only of the obvious, visible, earthly things, he's also, he says, the maker of the mysterious, invisible, heavenly things. He has a special reason for stressing that. Some of these Colossians, as we just said, were arguing that Jesus must be some kind of archangel or demigod. Paul's answer to that is to insist he can't possibly be an archangel or a demigod, for Jesus is himself the creator of the archangels and the demigods. He was, in fact, the creator of everything. So he existed before creation. He is the agent of creation. Paul has something even more to say about this matter. Jesus is also, he says, the sustainer of creation. Verse 17. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together. Fascinating word, that. All things cohere. That's one of the most interesting things that modern science has demonstrated, is that this universe fits into a single huge pattern. The same laws that control the fall of the apple control the orbit of the moon. The same equation that describes the behavior of the atom can also explain the inferno of the sun. At the heart of all physical phenomena, there is this unifying mathematical symmetry of a most beautiful kind. A delicate balance of different fundamental forces and elementary particles which conspire to make this world an ordered place, a harmonious place, a place where human beings can survive. Now, why is it so? What is the basis of this unity which makes of our world a universe rather than a chaos? Now, Paul says, it is Jesus. When you plumb the universe to its final depth, he says, you will find the sustaining principle of its coherence and its integration is not a mathematical equation, but a divine personality. He is the logic. He is the intelligence. He is the wisdom that gives the universe its rationality. That's why, of course, science is such an eminently Christian occupation. I hope all of you scientists here this morning feel very affirmed in your calling. Because whether you're looking at the remotest star picked up on a radio telescope or the tiniest particle detected in an electron microscope, these things connect with Jesus. He's the sustainer of it all. But even now Paul isn't satisfied. He said Jesus is before the universe, that he's the agent of creation. He said he's the sustainer of the universe. But he has yet one more thing to say under this heading. Jesus is also, he says, the purpose of creation. You see how he throws those two words in at the end of verse 16? Very tantalizing words. All things were created by him and for the question that we asked at the beginning of this second section in our study was not, how did we get here, but why are we here? I believe most of us ask that question. And we ask it because there is some deep intuition in us human beings which tells us that this world has a destiny. We are not just part of a meaningless journey to nowhere. There's a goal, there's a purpose to existence. Now, Paul agrees with that fiercely. And once again, he says, the clue to that cosmic goal is Jesus. He is not just the basis of a rationality of design in the universe. He is also the foundation of a rationality of purpose. The world is not only made by him, but for him. In other words, this great universe was planned as an arena in which he would accomplish something which God had purposed. That's what he's saying. In Jesus, we see the reason the whole of creation was brought into being. Well, more of that in a moment, but little wonder, just holding that in your mind for a moment, then, little wonder, is it, that Christianity makes exclusive claims? Little wonder it appears intolerant of other religions sometimes. Because whatever moral insights or mystical experiences or spiritual truths these other religions may contain, and I don't question that they do contain such things, Jesus stands alone. The source of the universe and its deepest secret. Of course he must have the supremacy. And that brings me to the third reason, which Paul gives us in our passage this morning for making that great affirmation. Because of Jesus' unique relationship to God, that was the first, remember? Because of his unique relationship to the universe, that's the second. Thirdly, because of Jesus' unique work on the cross. Look at verses 19 and 20 now. God was pleased to have all his fullness dwell in him, and through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether things on earth or things in heaven, by making peace through his blood shed on the cross. Now, to anyone who knows the story of Jesus' life, what Paul has been saying here in these earlier verses about Jesus' unique relationship to God and to the universe inevitably invites a very serious question. If Jesus is this amazing person you say he is, Paul, why on earth did he die? I mean, can the living image of God die? Can the one who sustains the universe die? And what a death it was, a savage, brutal, humiliating death at the hands of those very powers and thrones and authorities whom he was supposed to have created. Seems so utterly inconsistent, so contradictory. It's little wonder that Paul elsewhere speaks of the foolishness of the cross. Yet if we did but realize it, Paul says here, that cross, which seems such a perplexity, in fact constitutes Jesus' highest claim to uniqueness of all. See, if the first question a religion must answer is, what is God like? And the second question is, why are we here? Then I suggest to you maybe the third question any religion must answer is, how can the world be put right? For it's self-evident, no matter how much order and harmony and goodness and sense of destiny we are aware of in our world, we're also aware of a great deal of disorder, disharmony, evil, and a bewildering sense of lostness. How can the world be put right? Paul insists, the answer to that third question is also Jesus. The key lies in that word reconcile, which you see in verse 20. Notice it? Through him to reconcile to himself all things. Now, we all know what reconciliation is about. When you have an argument with somebody and then you make it up, we say you are reconciled. So the clear implication of Paul's use of that word reconciled here is that somehow the world and God have been put at odds with one another. A state of cosmic war has been declared. And if you look down at verse 21, you'll very quickly identify the cause of that cosmic war. Once, he says, you were alienated from God and were enemies in your minds because of your evil behavior. Well, behind Paul's compressed language here lies the whole dilemma of the human race as the Bible understands it. God gave to mankind, made in his image, the gift of moral freedom. And the dreadful consequence of that was that man used the gift of freedom to rebel against God's rule. He chose to do wrong. As he puts it here, he became an enemy of God in his mind. And so became alienated, became at enmity with God by virtue of his evil behavior. And the result of that is that the whole universe has been thrown out of joint. Evil has infected the angelic realms, those things in heaven that Paul so mysteriously talks about. So that some of those angelic forces have become demonic, conspiring in human rebellion. Evil has infected the earth itself. The scars of this spiritual conflict are seen in man's physical environment as God posts indications of his wrath and his judgment there. But it's within human society that the most tragic results are seen. Of this cosmic war, this moral alienation. Hatred and greed and pain and death spoil all the harmony and the joy which God had planned. The modern man uses the word alienation a great deal, doesn't he, to describe his plight. Paul uses it too. But when he uses it, he's just not talking about man's alienation from himself or from his neighbor. You were alienated from God. Now, it's conceivable, I suppose, that God could have simply written the whole universe off as a fiasco. He could have scrapped it and gone back to the drawing board, as we say. Indeed, since God can see the future, some of you might be asking yourself, well, if the world was going to go this wrong, why did he bother making it in the first place? But you see, that would have been an admission of defeat on God's part, wouldn't it? It would have meant that in some sense, at least, evil had won. God couldn't allow evil because he knew he couldn't beat it. Now the Bible tells us, from the very beginning of time, God determined he would beat it. God determined upon a much more difficult and an infinitely more costly strategy than simply writing the universe off. He wouldn't abandon this evil and ungrateful world that had rebelled against him. Now, he would save it. He would rescue it from the consequences of its own folly. He would deliver it from the judicial penalty of his own anger. In a word, he would reconcile the world to himself. He would destroy the enmity without destroying the enemy. He would make peace. And Paul tells us here, in very beautiful words, that when you look at Jesus on the cross, dying, that is what you see God doing. Making peace through his blood shed on a cross. Think of it this way. Suppose there's somebody who's very close to you, a member of your family, maybe a child or brother or sister or parent, husband or wife even, somebody very close to you who profoundly hurts you. They trample over your feelings. They completely ignore your wishes. In spite of all your kindness, they repay you with hatred, contempt. And now you see them in some kind of deep trouble. I mean, really serious trouble, life-threatening trouble. If you don't step in to help them, they're going to perish. Now, what do? You could tell them to go to hell. Indeed, you might feel perfectly justified in telling them to go to hell. After all, they'd done nothing to deserve your kindness. You didn't owe them anything after the way they've treated you. You might even get some satisfaction for all those wounded feelings you've been nursing if you told them to go to hell. But supposing, when you consult your feelings, you find within your heart there is still a love burning for them there. A love that wants to see them restored to your family circle again. What do you do then? Well, I suggest what you have to do then is to find some resources within yourself, some mechanism within yourself to absorb all that pain, all that injury, all that anger that boils up within you at the very sight of them, so that you can stretch out your hand and help them. I find that's a picture that helps me to understand what Paul is saying here, when he says God was reconciling us to himself through the blood of the cross. You see, Jesus and God were one. God was pleased to have all his fullness dwell in him. It's not insignificant. That's how Paul prefaces his remarks. Jesus was not somebody else. He was God on the cross. And what we see happening there then is God, in some extraordinary way, within the complexity of persons that comprise the Godhead, the Trinity, if you want to use that word, within that complexity of persons, we see God finding a way, finding a mechanism, finding resources whereby he can absorb within himself all the pain and the injury and the anger which is awoken in him, a righteous God, when he looks at people like us who have hurt him and sinned against him. We see on that cross a passionate collision of pain and fury and of love and mercy. He reconciled to himself all things through the blood Jesus shed on the cross. And says Paul, we know he succeeded in that. For the church is the evidence of the success. The church of Jesus is the nucleus of that reconciled community of men and women who have made peace with God, who now stand in his sight holy, without blemish, free from accusation. What's more, one day God intends to use that church, that reconciled human race, to populate a reconciled universe. For the reconciliation Jesus has achieved goes far beyond merely man, to embrace the whole of the cosmos. One day he's going to make a new heavens and a new earth in which righteousness dwells. And who will be there? As king, as lord of that reconciled world, it will be Jesus. Jesus risen from the dead, Jesus glorified and exalted. He is the head of the body, the church, he says. He is the beginning and the firstborn from among the dead. So, in everything, he has the supremacy. Now I ask you, how can anybody who understands what I've just been trying to explain about Jesus and his unique work on the cross, how can anybody who understands that possibly treat Muhammad or Krishna or Buddha as Jesus' equal? We're not derogating them, we're not disparaging them when we refuse to do that. The point is, have they rescued mankind from sin? Have they been the means of reconciling a rebel universe to God? Can any one of them say they have made peace by their blood shed on a cross? Have any of them got scars in their hands? No, they haven't. Prophets, mystics, gurus, they may be. But saviors, they are not. So when redeemed mankind stands on the last day in the presence of God, there will be no dissident voices. There'll be nobody saying three cheers for Muhammad. There'll be nobody waving a banner for Krishna. The entire universe on that last day will echo to the praise of a single name. At his name, every knee will bow in heaven and on earth. For there's no other name given under heaven whereby we must be saved. Jesus. There was a very great man preaching at Holy Trinity Church here in Cambridge. His name was Charles Simeon. Some of you may have read about him. He was an aged man by that time, in the 1830s. But he was still preaching. And in one of his final sermons, he preached on Colossians 1. He came to this verse, verse 18. Read it in the Old Authorized Version. In everything, he might have the preeminence, it says there. Those who saw him say that as he read those words, his old bent body visibly straightened in the pulpit, and he drew himself up the more passionately to impress those words on his congregation. That in all things he might have the preeminence. He must have it. He will have it. He shall have it, he said. They say the effect of that simple piece of rhetoric was quite electrifying from that old saint. And it's true. He must have the supremacy. He will have the supremacy. He shall have it. The pluralism of our 20th century may confuse us. It doesn't confuse heaven. He has the supremacy. The only uncertainty this morning is whether you and I will acknowledge that supremacy now, willingly, gladly, as penitent sinners who have been reconciled, as these Colossians were, presented before him holy, without blemish, and free from accusation. Or whether we shall acknowledge that supremacy on the last day, angrily, bitterly, resentfully, as though subdued by his sovereign power. That's the only uncertainty. Either way, the supremacy belongs to him. Let's pray together.